Please, sir, can you spare a few minutes to save a planet?
Radio EcoShock, sounds for an endangered world. Hi, I'm Alex Smith. Nature has her own voice. Hear it with EcoShock on Co-op Radio.
Out, expose those with stocking. That's a mobile X, I'm pumping mad toxin. Dioxin, no time for relaxing. My son, we basking, it's free energy.
Let's explore the Castle of Doom together, shall we? This week, we travel to a different planet with top NASA scientist James Hansen. Except, it's Earth. And we'll get there with King Coal. We'll talk about the binge of building coal-fired power plants all over the world. I'm not just talking about China and India. America's set to go black with up to 100 new coal plants. If they get built, the United States will surpass China's carbon boom. Even green talkers like Germany are going coal, and so is parts of Eastern Europe. As we find out, the planet may go with it. There is some hope and some heart. An Australian scientist will tell us how high winds in the Southern Ocean are whipping up waves that grab carbon dioxide at amazing rates. This may even slow down the runaway thermometer. But will it turn the oceans too acidic for coral and the basic life forms of the sea? The heart part comes from a batch of new songs, a whole new genre, climate music. Throughout the show, we'll be running selections from independent artists who are bringing art to the cause. This could be the search for concerts and anthems to save ourselves from global warming and mass extinctions. Feel the music. We start with Dr. James Hansen, head of the Goddard Space Center for NASA. I know you are busy, so I've grabbed the best quotes from his speech, and keeping with our theme today, we've set them to music. As usual, you can download the full speech from our website at www.ecoshock.org. We have 10 years left to reduce carbon dramatically or face a different and desolate planet. So says Dr. James Hansen in this speech to the Architecture 2030 conference on February 20, 2007. It's a remarkable speech by a scientist funded by the American government. The title is The Threat to the Planet and How We Can Avoid Dangerous Climate Change. The event was called a Global Emergency Teach-In and organized by the New York Academy of Sciences. Find out more at www.2010imperative.com.
The threat to the planet and how can we avoid dangerous climate change? The implication is that we can avoid dangerous climate change. So it's not a gloom and doom story, but it is an action story. If we don't begin to take the actions now, it will become a gloom and doom story. We can't begin 10 years from now or 20 years from now. We've got to begin this year and next year to take actions. That level of 1 degree warmer than today is the absolute maximum that we should allow human-made effects to change the planet, because otherwise we will be approaching the temperatures that existed in the middle Pliocene 3 million years ago, when it was a very different planet. Again, we have information from the history of the Earth. In general, when the planet has become warmer, the western U.S. has been drier and even had super droughts, and that's the danger that we face if we go to a very large level of global warming. And I would like to point out that the pie chart on the left shows that China is just about to catch the United States in current emissions, and within 2 or 3 years they will pass us as the largest emitter of carbon dioxide. But that will not relieve our responsibility, because what affects climate is the integrated emissions over time. And we have emitted more than three times any other country. China and Russia are approximately tied for second, but we're more than a factor of three greater than either of those countries. And so for many decades into the future, we are going to be the primary cause of the global climate change. And in fact, our responsibility runs deeper than that, because we have discouraged the attainment of international accords that are designed to try to take the first steps towards solving the problem. And on a per capita basis, we're the largest emitter of carbon dioxide, with Canada and Australia very close behind us. There have been large global warmings in the past. The last really big one was 55 million years ago, when the Earth warmed up about 6 degrees Celsius, and it caused the extinction of more than 90% of the species on the planet. Well, of course, these climate changes in the past, although they drove many species to extinction, new species came in to replace them, but that requires, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of years. And if we drive species to extinction now, it will be a much more desolate planet for any time period that humanity is concerned about. If we're going to stretch the readily available oil and gas long enough until we can develop new technologies that don't produce CO2, we're going to need to use that oil and gas judiciously. We're going to need to emphasize efficiencies. We are wasting these very precious resources. An important point, which is not appreciated by the public and policymakers, I think, is the fact that approximately a quarter of the carbon dioxide that we put in the air will stay there forever. By that I mean more than 500 years, which for all practical purposes is forever. And so that's the reason that we cannot exploit the unconventional fossil fuels or the coal unless we're going to capture the CO2 and sequester it. There is still time to solve this problem, but we need to begin to take actions now. If we stay on business as usual for just another 10 years, so to 2017, by that time, emissions of CO2 will be more than 40% higher than they were in year 2000. But the alternative scenario that I mentioned and did not have time to go into in detail requires that we reduce emissions and be lower by about 30% by the time we get to the middle of the century. But if we're 40% above 2000 emissions in 10 years, there's no practical way that we can get back onto that track. So we really can't wait another 10 years to begin to change the track that we're on. There's just too much pressure from the special interests. And the energy departments and the fossil fuel companies think that they can continue business as usual. And the energy departments make curves for the future energy use and the future fuel use that assumes that more and more use of fossil fuels without capture of CO2 is a God-given fact. It doesn't need to be. We've made changes in our energy use in the past, but it's not going to happen without some pressure on the politicians that exceeds the pressure from the special interests. And in that regard, I would particularly like to make note of the plans for demonstrations that Bill McKibben and organization they call Step It Up 07. You can find information on stepitup07.org. They plan to have peaceful demonstrations about this issue on April 14th. And I think it would be very helpful if the politicians would see that there are a large number of people who are beginning to be concerned about this, because there are so many advantages in beginning to address the problem and beginning to address it soon that we should be doing it. But it's not going to happen unless people make clear that they want it to happen. Thanks. Yeah, I forgot to mention, anything that I say that relates to policy is my personal opinion, and I'm not representing my agency or the government.
You have been listening to Dr. James Hansen in this speech to the Architecture 2030 conference on February 20, 2007. The event was called A Global Emergency Teach-In and organized by the New York Academy of Sciences. Find out more at www.2010imperative.com. This audio was prepared by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. Let's get back to the 60s, where you could drive your Corvette across the country and never know where the exhaust went. It's Endless Summer by a band called Ghostly Penguin Display.
I'm going cruising in my Woody, lighting up my barbecue, turning on the air conditioner, nice to see you, CO2. Waxing up my brand new surfboard, making pure Brazilian trees. Once I lived 10 miles inland, now my front yard is a sea. It's gonna be an endless summer, let's all hop in the Hummer. And it's such a bummer that the water is so warm. It's an endless season, and it stands to reason that we can all make it through the next big storm. There's no more fish left in the ocean, the polar bears have jumped the shark. No more oil in the desert, we're left sitting in the dark. Now it's summer the whole year long, no one ever sees the snow. Getting hotter every day now, what we'll do God only knows. It's gonna be an endless summer, in the Hummer, and it's such a bummer that the water is so warm. It's an endless season, and it stands to reason that we can all make it through the next big storm.
Well, we might as well get down and dirty early in the show. Pop your antidepressants now, while the Christian Science Monitor counts out all the new coal plants and the carbon burden. I'm going to read you a story from the Christian Science Monitor. Global Boom in Coal Power and Emissions, from the March 22, 2000 edition, by Mark Clayton. A monitor analysis shows the potential for an extra 1.2 billion tons of carbon released into the atmosphere per year. Forget the documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. disregard rising public concern over global warming, ignore the Kyoto Protocol. The world certainly is, at least when it comes to building new electric power plants. In the past 5 years, it has been on a coal-fired binge, bringing new generators online at a rate of better than 2 per week. That has added some 1 billion tons of new carbon dioxide emissions that humans pump into the atmosphere each year. Coal-fired power now accounts for nearly a third of human-generated global CO2 emissions. So what does the future hold? An acceleration of the buildup, according to a monitor analysis of the power industry data. Despite Kyoto limits on greenhouse gases, the analysis shows that nations will add enough coal-fired capacity in the next 5 years to create an extra 1.2 billion tons of CO2 per year. Those accelerating the buildup are not the usual suspects. Take China, which is widely blamed for the rapid rise in greenhouse gas emissions. Indeed, China accounted for nearly two-thirds of the more than 560 coal-fired power plants built in 26 nations between 2002 and 2006. The Chinese plants boosted annual world CO2 emissions by 740 million tons. But in the next 5 years, China is slated to slow its buildup by half, according to industry estimates, adding 333 million tons of new CO2 emissions every year. That's still the largest increase of any nation, but other nations appear intent on catching up. Really, it's been the story of what China is doing, says Steve Piper, Managing Director of Power Forecasting at Platts, the Energy Information Division of McGraw-Hill that provided country-by-country power plant data to the monitor. But it's also a story of unabated global growth in coal-fired power. We're seeing diversification away from pricier natural gas and crude oil. Coal looks cheap and attractive, and countries with coal resources see an opportunity that wasn't there before. For example, the United States is accelerating its buildup dramatically. In the past 5 years, it built 2.7 gigawatts of new coal-fired generating capacity. But in the next 5 years, it is slated to build 37.7 gigawatts of capacity, enough to produce 247 million tons of CO2 per year, extra, according to Platts. That would vault the U.S. to second place, just ahead of India, in adding new capacity. Even nations that have pledged to reduce global warming under the Kyoto Treaty are slated to accelerate their buildup of coal-fired power plants. For example, 8 EU nations, Germany, Italy, Poland, Spain, Bulgaria, Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, plan to add nearly 13 gigawatts of new coal-fired capacity by 2012. That's up from about 2.5 gigawatts over the past 5 years. And new countries are joining the coal-fired binge. In all, at least 37 nations plan to add coal-fired capacity in the next 5 years, up from the 26 nations that added capacity during the last five. With Sri Lanka, Laos, and even oil-producing nations like Iran getting set to join the coal-powered pack, the world faces the prospect 5 years from now of having 7,474 coal-fired power plants in 79 countries, pumping out 9 billion tons of CO2 emissions annually, out of 31 billion tons from all sources in 2012. These numbers show how far in the wrong direction the world is poised to go, and indicate a lot of private sector investors who still don't get it in terms of global warming, says David Hawkins, Climate Center Director of the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington. This rapid buildup of global warming machines, which is what coal-fired power plants are, should be a wake-up call to politicians that we're driving ever faster towards the edge of the cliff. But the cliff can be avoided, some researchers say, without having to reduce the world's energy consumption. If carbon dioxide gas could be captured at power plants and then pumped underground and permanently sequestered in layers of rock, then coal might continue to be used without damaging the climate, concluded a major report by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, released last week. In that light, whether or not China decides to build power plants that sequester carbon dioxide underground will be a central question. Right now, based on those power plants that Platts has been able to verify, overall construction growth could be tapering off, but none of them is expected to sequester emissions, and estimates of how many plants China expects to build vary widely. That leaves climate scientists and policy experts wondering how to influence power plant construction in China and India. A huge factor is whether the EU and the US are able to persuade the Chinese to build plants that capture and sequester CO2. Much depends on the US, because China is unlikely to sequester its carbon dioxide if the US does not, analysts say. The Chinese won't be able to go forward by themselves, says Dr. Andrew Speed. They're going to need EU, Japan, and the US together to help them and set a good example. Right now, the U.S. is planning to build more than 150 coal-fired power plants that don't sequester their emissions, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Platts' short list of those most likely to be built in 5 years lists 64 power plants, which would still vault the U.S. into a virtual tie with India at 38,000 megawatts of new coal output. If that happens, the U.S. alone would add 250 million tons a year of CO2 emissions to the atmosphere, on top of the billions its power plants already emit. The recent decision by new owners of TXU not to build 8 coal-fired power plants gives some reason for hope. The good news is the politicians have their hands on the steering wheel, Dr. Hawkins says. If they would just turn the wheel towards sequestration, then we don't have to go over this cliff. To date, many climate models have not fully accounted for the worldwide acceleration of coal-fired power plants, scientists say. The phenomenon would lead to greater CO2 emissions than most business-as-usual forecasts project, said Dr. Robert Sokolow, co-director of the Carbon Mitigation Initiative at Princeton University, in an email. So they're building them, my friends, the global warming machines that will burn down the world.
Sinners, are you ready for a little redemption, to receive forgiveness for what we've done? The time has come to break bad habits. It's time to turn to the wind and sun. Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. There's a better way than barrels of oil. There's a better way than lumps of coal. There's a better way to work together. Renewable power, that's our goal.
That's our goal.
Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. What will we do for a better world? Get on your knees to hope and pray. That's not enough unless we change. The judgment day is every day. Wars have been fought over who owns what. Lives have been lost and fortunes won. But you and I will someday win. Cause no one owns,
cause no one owns
the wind or sun. Just a little more power from above, just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength
to say no to that power from below. But there's salvation in the power from above. Just a little more power from above. Just a little more faith, respect, and love for this old earth, our only home. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. Yes, there's salvation in the power from above.
That was Power from Above by Dan Berggren. If you want to check out his other music, Google Berggren. There's three R's in there. Now here's a little something from Al Gore as he testifies to Congress for the first time since he was vice president.
Because I promise you, I say this to each of you as individuals, I promise you, a day will come when our children and grandchildren will look back and they'll ask one of two questions. Either they will ask, what in God's name were they doing? Didn't they see the evidence? Didn't they realize that four times in 15 years the entire scientific community of this world issued unanimous reports calling upon them to act? What was wrong with them? Were they too blinded and numbed by the busyness of political life or daily life to take a deep breath and look at the reality of what we're facing? Did they think it was perfectly all right to keep dumping 70 million tons every single day of global warming pollution into this Earth's atmosphere? Did they think all the scientists were wrong? What were they thinking? Or they'll ask another question. They may look back and they'll say, how did they find the uncommon moral courage to rise above politics and redeem the promise of American democracy and do what some said was impossible and shake things up and tell the special interests, okay, we've heard you and we're going to do the best we can to take your considerations into account, but we're going to do what's right.
Al Gore in testimony to the U.S. Congress, March 21st, 2007.
Brothers and sisters, the time has come for each and every one of you to decide whether you are going to be the problem or whether you are going to be the solution.
That's right.
You must choose, brothers. You must choose. And take 5 seconds to realize that it's time to move. Brothers, it's time to testify. And I want to know, are you ready to testify?
Yes, we are ready. Tune in April 17th for an all-day radio marathon. Emergency on Planet Earth. 8 hours, 12 noon to 8 p.m. Despair and hope for the environment. We testify for Planet Earth on your radio station, CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio. April 17th, mark your calendar. Learn, listen, and howl with CFRO as we start the countdown to meltdown or survival. Tell them, Al.
Did they think it was perfectly all right to keep dumping 70 million tons every single day of global warming pollution into this Earth's atmosphere?
High water rising, river licking at my door. Muddy waters, hey, you can't stay here anymore. Throw your good seed in the field, now it's mud in every road. Muddy waters, hey, try to reap the seed you sowed. You can run up to the high ground, you can run and you can hide. Muddy waters, hey, try to turn away the tide. Smokestack horizon, like a giant cloud machine. Muddy water say, quench your thirst with gasoline.
High Water Rising reminds me of Louisiana, and singer Joel Zifkin is definitely from the South. I promised you a little good news. Let's start with this short Al Gore clip where he tells Congress about the Electronet, the power grid friendly to alternative energy.
This Congress should enact a moratorium on the construction of any new coal-fired power plant that is not compatible with carbon capture and sequestration. And that means that we should have an all-out push to develop carbon capture and sequestration. Next, I believe, Mr. Chairman, that just as this committee and the Science and Technology Committee were instrumental in the early years assisting the scientists and engineers to take what was then known as ARPANET and DARPANET and develop the new switches and the new high-performance computers and assist them in their creation of what became the Internet. I believe that this Congress should develop an Electronet, a smart grid, just as the widely distributed processing of information everywhere in this country and around the world led to the biggest new surge of productivity that we've ever seen in this nation. We ought to have a law that allows homeowners and small business people to put up photovoltaic generators and small windmills and any other new sources of widely distributed generation that they can come up with, and allow them to sell that electricity into the grid without any artificial caps, at a rate that is determined not by a monopsony. Of course, as you know, that's the flip side of a monopoly. You can have the tyranny of a single seller. You can also have the tyranny of a single buyer. And if the utility sets the price, then it'll never get off the ground. But if it's a tariff, if it's regulated according to what the market for electricity is, same way public utility commissions do it now, then you might never need another central station generating plant. In the same way that the Internet took off and stimulated the information revolution, we could see a revolution all across this country with small-scale generation of electricity everywhere. Let people sell it. Don't reserve it for the single big seller.
Al Gore in testimony to the U.S. Congress, March 21st, 2007. Now we go to ABC Australia for a program that has just gotten better and better. It's simply called The Science Show. The host is Robin Williams. He reads a dozen or more science papers a week and seems to know scads of scientists in many parts of the world. His James Lovelock interviews are classics. Today, Robin interviews Joellen Russell about the behavior of waves in the Southern Ocean. And yes, this does matter to you. More than two decades ago, scientists realized a simple calculation of the amount of greenhouse gas pollution tossed into the atmosphere should mean we are roasting already. Why not? About half the carbon was disappearing somewhere. It goes into the ocean, and a good thing it does. Carbon dioxide, for example, gets grabbed by the sea in the thin layer where waves rise and then fall, trapping air, which mixes into the upper layers of the ocean. New science is showing that mechanism is working stronger than anyone thought in the ocean south of Australia and around Antarctica. That's partly because the belt of winds that used to bring rain to southern Australia, remember their drought and fires now? It's moved closer to the South Pole. The same movement of wind systems is happening in the Northern Hemisphere, too. We think it's part of climate change. Those stronger winds in the Southern Ocean are very powerful. The sea there is being whipped up. As we'll hear, one scientist calculates this interaction may be stripping up to 20% of the world's carbon right out of the air. Things would be much worse except for this change. But how long can the sea take up our extra carbon dioxide before it becomes weakly acidic, like a can of cola? Let's tune in to The Science Show with Robin Williams.
Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
You're on ABC Radio National, and in today's Science Show, we visit some Australians making big waves in research around the world. Hello, I'm Robin Williams. Big waves, mainly in America. It's surprising how many clever Australians are out there involved at the highest levels. Speaking of waves, ocean waves themselves this time, new research in Arizona shows they could be burying far more CO2 than anyone imagined. Professor Joellen Russell has found that near our own region, the system is having some really surprising effects.
Well, I actually run a global climate model attached to an ocean model. What we're looking at is the coupled climate system and how it interacts, which is these very big winds. They are the largest, strongest mean surface winds in the world. They're 30% higher than the jet stream in the northern hemisphere. So you have the strongest winds, which is why you have the biggest storms, right? But these strong winds are actually moving towards the pole around Antarctica, which means that we're actually, we think, from our climate model results, getting increased mixing and a bigger Antarctic circumpolar current.
Why are they moving south?
Well, it's something that a lot of teams are working on, but I'll speculate because this is what we're doing. And in the models, at least, it's moving towards the poles because of global warming. As we're warming the troposphere, basically we're cooling that atmosphere that lays above the troposphere, the stratosphere. And that gradient between these two is increasing, meaning so the difference between the very cold air near space, very warm air near the surface is getting bigger. And as it's getting bigger, the winds are popping. The jet stream is moving towards the poles in both hemispheres, but particularly around Antarctica.
And what's the effect of that in terms of CO2, do you think?
Well, this is what's exciting, is that everywhere else in the world ocean, we're expecting the surface ocean to warm and get very stable, very, very stable, and slow the amount of mixing, which will slow the rate of uptake of CO2. But in the southern ocean, because these winds are moving towards Antarctica, the mixing's increasing. And this is a very unexpected result, because all the climate models in the last generation said, hey, it's all going to cap and get slow and kind of sluggish. But instead, around Antarctica, things are really starting to rip. And with that mixing, we think the southern ocean will take up about 20% more carbon dioxide over the next 100 years than would have been taken up without the wind shift, which is an astonishing result. I mean, 20% more CO2 out of the total global, which is a big number.
But why would that happen? Because the ocean is warmer?
Well, mostly it's because the Antarctic Circumpolar Current, which is the ocean current that runs underneath the jet stream that's driven by the big winds around Antarctica, that circumpolar current brings water from about 3 kilometers deep to the surface. And we expected that with time, the warming would make that get shallower and shallower and shallower, weaker current. But that's not what's happening. In fact, the current has been strengthening. We've got more water coming to the surface, which means water that has never seen all this man-made CO2 is making it to the surface and then being sunk back to the depth. So basically producing this big sequestration of CO2. We're pulling it out of the air and sinking it back to the deep ocean.
So this is the theory. Have you actually measured that this is going on in the real water?
Well, I actually don't go out and make the measurements anymore.
Especially now you're about to have a baby.
That's right. I'm about 1 or 2 weeks away here. I wish he'd hurry up. But yes, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, as well as other places like Australia and CSIRO, have been going out and making lots and lots of measurements of the surface ocean carbon dioxide fluxes, as well as the deep ocean carbon. And there have been several blockbuster papers recently saying, hey, did you know that the Southern Ocean is taking up about half of the global anthropogenic carbon dioxide, which is very unexpected if it were capping. So we think actually that the model is actually representing what's really happening in the ocean. So
now what does this mean? If something like half of the man-made CO2 That's going to make a huge difference.
Yes, that's a huge amount. And what it does is there's two parts. One is not only is it carbon dioxide that's going into the ocean, but it's all that man-made heat, too, the heating in the atmosphere. Some portion of that is going into the ocean. And so we've seen from measurements, this is not my work, it's Sarah Gilley at Scripps Institution Oceanography, she showed that the Southern Ocean is warming faster than anywhere else on Earth. And it's because of this great mixing that we think it's going on. But second, when you remove all that CO2, it's not in the air anymore to contribute to global warming. So we think we could basically slow global warming. We can't stop it, we can't reverse it, but we can slow global warming significantly by this increase in the winds and the change in the mixing in the Southern Ocean.
Because one thing that your colleagues at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography did say, that as the CO2 goes into the ocean, it makes it more acidic, which is a problem for corals and shellfish and all the rest of it. But in fact, if you're sequestering, if the current is taking it way down deep, that isn't so much of a worrying effect, or what?
Well, the problem is that the Southern Ocean tends to mix from the surface all the way to the deep. So it's not just the deep ocean that's getting this extra dose of CO2. Unfortunately, it probably does mean that we are making the ocean more acidic from top to bottom. This is one of the two big downsides. The first one being more acidic ocean, which means pteropods and corals and anybody who needs to make their architecture out of aragonite or calcium carbonate is under threat. And many of these organisms are the base of the food web globally in the ocean. This is very serious. And we're running new simulations with all the biology in it just to double check. You know, we'd like to know what's going to happen next. But the second thing that's happening is that the more heat you put in the ocean, the faster sea level rises, because warmer water expands. And sea level will rise more quickly the more heat we pour in. So although this is good because it removes heat from the atmosphere and carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, the bad part is it's in the ocean now, and there are consequences.
Yeah, indeed. Those aren't the Air Force planes going above us.
No, that's just regular air traffic.
Because we're standing next to a place where, in fact, the Iraq troops are being debriefed.
Yes, some of them are debriefed just south of here. We have a couple of different military bases that are big hubs for that. Mm.
To sum up, you've obviously discussed this, but what really does it mean in terms of the good news about global warming? How much might it reduce the problem we've got, and how much time might it give us?
Well, what it meant for our climate sensitivity in the model was that basically it took almost 20 to 40 more years to reach the same temperature in the atmosphere with the new model. If this is true, if we're right, then we're basically getting a little bit more grace time to get our act in order.
But the sea level will still be going up.
Sea level will still be going up. It will still be warming in the atmosphere, but more slowly than we might have thought.
It's a complex system this you're dealing with, isn't it?
It is. It really is.
Jo Ellen Russell is Associate Professor of Geoscience at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And I asked Susan Solomon, who wrote the IPCC report from the American side on climate, about whether they have evidence of a slowing down of CO2. And she said the overall carbon dioxide situation is unchanged, but it's very much worth watching.
Robin asked another guest about the acid problem.
And so to our very first expat Aussie. He's the new director of the renowned Scripps Institution of Oceanography, mentioned just now, Professor Tony Haymet, ex-CSIRO in Hobart. He heads the very outfit where they found the CO2 rise 50 years ago. What about this question of CO2 dissolving in the ocean and acidifying it, which on the Science Show a few weeks ago was suggested might in fact dissolve reefs and indeed some of the shellfish?
Well, for a chemist like me, that's a very attractive problem, and I must say I'm reading a lot about that. I'm quite concerned about it. I think the science is unequivocal that CO2 is dissolving in the ocean and increasing the acidity to places that we haven't seen probably for 44 million years. And we've already come down a tenth of a pH unit, and there's already another 2/10 that are already built into the system. That will place the pH of at least the surface of the ocean in a regime that it hasn't experienced.
It's been suggested that by 2065, I don't know why that date, reefs and indeed shellfish may have been devastated. Would you agree with that?
I think it's not impossible. I'm more concerned about these little organisms called pteropods that need to make exoskeletons. They're an important part of the food web. I think even laboratory experiments now show that they have difficulty making those exoskeletons in a pH that's much less than it is today. So I think we do need to figure out the exact response of the whole food web to the increasing acidity of the ocean.
Dr. Tony Haymet is director of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography.
And finally, most scary of all, he finds that Ralph Keeling, son of the famous Keeling curve scientist, fears that if we don't control our emissions, all of us will experience wave after wave of climate change. We may be reeling from one massive storm system when the weather shifts again, unpredictably, for agriculture, transportation, and all the plant and animal species. You know, I wonder whether there will be some sort of mass migration routes for these animals, or maybe we'll just bring them up in trucks. We'll have a semi-truck full of robins bringing them north as the climate shifts out from under them.
There's room for hope. My wish would be that we could look at global warming as a human challenge with some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. But to have a light at the end of the tunnel, we have to get off this business as usual, every year more fossil fuel burning course that we're on right now. We have to get to a stabilization sometime in the next 50 years or so. Otherwise, this is going to be unlike anything humans have experienced before, with continuing climate change and continuing disruption. And the concern is that once we're through one wave of change, we'll be bracing for the next one. We won't know where to go to settle down anymore.
Ralph Keeling, who's actually found that oxygen is going down a little in the atmosphere, and his work is also on the Science Show next week. And you're listening to the Science Show on ABC Radio National.
Well, we need a song after that. This one is by Linda Allen, available at www.lindasongs.com. I like the homemade singing group she put together for We Are the Rainbow Sign.
We are the rainbow sign, we are the rainbow sign. The water keeps rising and there's not much time. We are the rainbow sign.
God told Noah it's fire next time.
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
The next flood that's coming is no work of mine.
We are the rainbow sign.
God said, child, we've been here before.
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
Blood in the streets and endless wars.
We are the rainbow sign.
God said, people, take a look around.
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
Ice is melting and the polar bears drown.
We are the rainbow sign. We are the rainbow sign. We are the rainbow sign. Water keeps rising and there's not much time. We are the rainbow sign.
God said, people, don't you understand?
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
This time the flood's by your own hand.
We are the rainbow sign.
This sweet earth is a paradise.
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
Turn it out of your car, turn out the light.
We are the rainbow sign.
If you love this planet, take a look around.
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
Your feet are planted on fragile ground.
We are the rainbow sign. We are the rainbow sign. We are the rainbow sign. Water keeps rising and there's not much time. We are the rainbow sign.
It's the oil, it's the coal, it's the automobile.
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
The planet is sending one last appeal.
We are the rainbow sign.
Your children's children know it's up to you.
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
If you love this earth, you know what to do.
We are the rainbow sign.
We've done the studies, we know the facts.
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
Mother Earth's crying and it's time.
We are the rainbow sign. We are the rainbow sign. We are the rainbow sign. Water keeps rising and there's not much time. We are the rainbow sign.
What would you lose to save your life?
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
No boat's gonna float without sacrifice.
We are the rainbow sign.
It's an inconvenient truth we all must fix.
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
We are the future of the human race.
We are the rainbow sign.
So raise your voices past the earth and sky.
Water keeps rising and there's not much time.
Sing praise to the waters and the birds that fly.
We are the rainbow sign.
Praise the fire of the spirit that makes us new.
water keeps it rising and there's not much time.
And the fire in me and the fire in you.
We are the rainbow sun. We are the rainbow sun. We are the rainbow sun. Water keeps it rising and there's not much time. We are the rainbow sun. We are the rainbow sun. We are the rainbow sun. Water keeps rising and there's not much time. We are the rainbow sun.
We'll save this earth while there's still time.
We are the rainbow sun.
Get the answers. April 17th, join CFRO Co-op Radio for the first ever all-day marathon for Earth. From noon to 8 at night, we'll scare, amuse, and motivate you to change before it's too late. Help save a planet. Tune in April 17th for our emergency marathon broadcast right here on 102.7 FM, The People's Station.
I promise you, a day will come when our children and grandchildren will look back, and they'll ask one of two questions. Either they will ask, what in God's name were they doing? Didn't they see the evidence? Didn't they realize that four times in 15 years, the entire scientific community of this world issued unanimous reports calling upon them to act? What was wrong with them?
This is the most serious problem facing humanity in the 21st century. If we don't address it, we'll undermine and perhaps destroy civilization.
Yeah.
That was Clatter with House of Trouble. Find them at www.clatter.com.
Stop it before it begins. Don't focus on when it will end.
Coming to CFRO April 18th. Climate Crisis, Solutions, Scams, and Survival. This two-hour special from Radio EcoShock will visit what works and what doesn't. Crazy ideas, long-shot tech, fossil fuel lies and illusions. We need to dodge the carbon bullet and look the climate crash right in the face. That's April 18th from 6 to 8 p.m. Radio EcoShock hits the climate crisis right here on CFRO 102.7 FM. Tune in April 18th, 6 to 8 p.m.
Stop it before it begins. On when it will end. Don't focus on when it will end.
In the background there, you heard Rosa Minstrels. She puts it rightly. When it comes to climate change, let's stop it before it begins and not focus on the end of everything. Find her at rosaminstrels.com. That's as much as we could cram in for this week. Find Radio EcoShock every Friday on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. You can get that by cable anywhere in British Columbia, by Star Choice Satellite anywhere in the world on Channel 845, and over the net at www.coopradio.org. Check out our past shows at ecoshock.org. You'll find a ton of free downloads, plus a 24-hour custom all-environment radio channel broadcasting over the web. Free and ad-free. We'll go out with Rosa Minstrels before it begins. Thanks for listening to Radio EcoShock.